Here's what Between the Lines featured last week.
First of all, this announcement is in line with a number of different steps that the Trump administration has taken that have really been ideologically driven and focused specifically on dismantling everything that has been known as the peace process, and specifically, you know, any achievements and any hopes that Palestinians had.
We've known from some of Stephen Miller's early writings or writings in college when he attended Duke University of having some connections, which he's denied, interactions with some white supremacists and particularly a white nationalist named Richard Spencer.
If they had taken the $1.5 billion that they had put into this plant, into the research that's required for renewable energies, we'd be far ahead of where we are now.
Here's what we're featuring this week on Between the Lines on Progressive Voices Network.
If we go above 2 degrees Celsius, the impacts will be even more severe. That's why it's stunning that the UN Emissions Gap Report shows that if we continue at our current levels, we'll be at 3.2 degrees Celsius by 2100, which is an absolute point of no return.
Klobuchar, Biden, Buttigieg, Booker, Harris, these are folks who are basically corporate-oriented politicians. They flirt with progressive populism. They don't want to consummate it. They've got their fingers to the wind.
Do they ever think of the indigenous people who were forced from their homelands? Do they understand that with every step they take, no matter the direction, that they are walking on stolen land?
All that's next on Between the Lines Radio News Magazine, heard here on Progressive Voices Network, Saturday 2 to 3 p.m. and Sunday 3 to 4 p.m. Eastern Time. Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Climate Action Group 350.org's North America Director, Tamara Towles O'Loughlin, who discusses the challenges at the UN's Madrid Climate Conference and the urgent need for rapid and transformational action to address climate change. Norman Solomon, co-founder of RootsAction.org, who talks about the recent corporate Democratic and media attacks on Senators Warren and Sanders for their progressive policy positions advocating a wealth tax, Medicare for all, and free college education. And U.S. political prisoner Leonard Peltier, who sent his annual greetings to those gathered for the Thanksgiving Day of Mourning in Plymouth, Massachusetts. But first we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
2 years after George W. Bush invaded Afghanistan in 2001, the nation's president at the time, Hamid Karzai, cut a ceremonial ribbon to open the rebuilt Kabul to Kandahar highway. Opening the road project was a critical priority of President Bush, who insisted the 300-mile highway be opened before winter set in. However, over time, the U.S.-funded highway has been crushed by heavy traffic it was never designed to carry, cracked by explosions from roadside bombs, with many of its bridges and culverts blown up by the Taliban. As the Christian Science Monitor observed, the U.S. has spent more in Afghanistan than it did rebuilding Europe after World War II. While the effort has boosted women's rights, education, and the middle class, it has also resulted in vast waste and corruption, as well as creating a sense of dependency among Afghans. The Taliban insurgency now controls or has influence across more than half of Afghanistan and is advancing. Yet the price of reconstruction paid by the U.S. has now topped $132 billion, in addition to the far higher cost of the war itself, which is at least six times greater. During a surprise Thanksgiving visit to Afghanistan, President Trump announced the resumption of peace talks with the Taliban, but after 18 years, hope for ending America's longest war may be more wishful thinking than reality. In the early days of 2019, 100 people waited for work visas outside the U.S. Embassy in Guatemala City, only to discover they were victims of a scam. The Guatemalan nationals had spent a year meeting with job recruiters with the promise of farm jobs in the United States. The workers invested thousands of dollars and traveled to the capital city to pursue their dreams for better-paying jobs. In the end, the workers lost all of their savings. While the Trump administration has imposed major obstacles to desperate migrants seeking asylum in the U.S., the government promotes guest worker programs to bring in low-wage workers. The goal for many migrants is to secure a U.S. H-2A visa that would allow them to cross the border to pick crops. But according to migrant advocates in a report published in the Christian Science Monitor, the system of recruiting foreign workers is ripe for abuse. A recent scam in Guatemala may have affected as many as 300 people who each lost about $1,300 paid to phony recruiters. Guatemala's public prosecutor's office says that it's investigating cases that included almost 5,000 victims at the end of 2016. Some scam victims are looking for justice from U.S. courts, including 19 Guatemalans who claimed they were forced to pay a recruiter $1,000 each in the state of Georgia. But because most payments to recruiters are paid in cash, there is no paper trail for prosecutors to follow. Democratic presidential candidate Pete Buttigieg has surged to the top of the polls in Iowa and New Hampshire. But Buttigieg, who currently serves as mayor of South Bend, Indiana, has very little support among African-American voters, which will likely hurt the 37-year-old gay candidate in South Carolina and other primary states. This past June, in the middle of his campaign, Buttigieg returned home after a police officer gunned down a black man in South Bend. Anger at the police shooting and Mayor Pete's response in the city's black community has dogged his campaign ever since. In June, the Buttigieg campaign launched what it called its Douglas Plan, named for abolitionist Frederick Douglass, that proposes to use federal contracting rules to increase the amount of government contracts going to minority and women-owned firms to 25%, touted as the most comprehensive roadmap for tackling systemic racism offered by a 2020 presidential candidate. When the campaign listed 400 South Carolinian supporters of the Douglas Plan, the Intercept news site found that three prominent African-American state legislators identified as having endorsed the plan felt that the use of their names had misrepresented their support of the plan and Buttigieg's candidacy. Although rolling out the big list of backers was intended to show broad support in the black community, the mistakes made by the campaign highlighted the opposite reality. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Anna Manzo.
As countries and civil society groups around the world prepare to send delegates to the 25th United Nations Climate Change Conference in Madrid, Spain, UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres warned on December 1st that the international efforts to stop climate change have been utterly inadequate so far, and there's a danger global warming could soon pass the point of no return. The UN chief cited recent scientific research that underscored his concern. The Emissions Gap Report found that with the current country pledges, the world is heading for a 3.2 degrees Celsius temperature rise, with G20 nations accounting for 78% of all emissions. The most recent World Meteorological Report shows that the concentration of climate heating greenhouse gas emissions has hit a record high, with no sign of a slowdown or decline, despite commitments made under the Paris Climate Accord. And the Production Gap Report finds that the world is on track to produce about 50% more fossil fuels in 2030 than would be consistent with limiting global warming to 2 degrees Celsius and 120% more than would be consistent with limiting warming to 1.5 degrees Celsius. Your reporter spoke with Tamara Tolles O'Loughlin, Climate Action Group 350.org's North America Director. Here she discusses the significance of the latest UN reports, the goals of the Madrid Climate Summit, and the urgent need for rapid and transformational change to address climate change.
COP25 in Madrid is really poised to discuss curbing global emissions. And for us, that's stopping coal, oil, and gas production. And we're demanding that concrete action rather than just pledges and promises come from this particular gathering, because the Paris Agreement doesn't even mention fossil fuels. So getting to where we need to go from that starting point is a big shift. The meetings themselves will cover loss and damage and really think through the necessity of compensating vulnerable communities, looking for space to work through climate impacts. This is a period where thoughts and prayers just aren't going to be enough. People need to see real money in real time. So as we're entering what we refer to as the climate decade, those 10 critical years that we have to turn things around and push for radical transformation that brings down emissions, we really need to do more than what we have done. And in 20 years of having these conversations, we've never shown up in the ways that we need to. So the main obstacles to progress at this meeting are people playing politics with our lives. Our countries, including and all of the global north, including Europe and Canada, as well as the U.S. and world powers like India and China and Brazil, have to show up for radical transformation. They have to commit immediately to halting coal, oil, and gas infrastructure and make plans to transition off of these fuels in a way that allows us to move our old business into the business that will support us sustainably. And currently, what we're up against, we're witnessing devastating impacts of climate breakdown on a daily basis around the globe, from the wildfires in L.A. to the ones in the Congo and Australia, and devastating floods in Europe, and more extreme events like Sandy. Entire communities and ecosystems are being impacted, and there's nothing except immorality that's keeping us from expanding fossil fuel production. We're continuing down this road where we put money into things that are destroying us instead of investing into the future. And that is essentially the conversation that's happening in COP25, is what is it going to take for us to go above and beyond what was then aggressive in the Paris Climate Agreement in 2014? And what can we do to make sure that the pledges that are made by each of these countries goes as far as we need them to go?
Tamara, during the last climate summit, there was a lot of discussion about keeping the rise of global temperatures to 2 degrees Celsius, and if possible, limit it to 1.5 degrees Celsius. Talk about those numbers, which I think to the average person may not mean a lot. What's the significance of 1.5 degrees and 2 degrees and the predictions that we're heading towards 3 and 4 degrees warmer temperature across the planet?
Sure. Well, I'm going to provide a little shorthand and say that my family is from all over the U.S. and a little bit of the Caribbean. So for my part, I can tell you that if we go up any higher than 1.5 degrees, every place you love to visit will be extinguished. The island and nation states of people who have done nothing to cause climate change will no longer be able to live on their homes, because as extreme weather event after extreme weather event has proven, they cannot withstand the damage that is coming. The consequences are really dire. So the difference between 2 degrees Celsius and 1.5 degrees above pre-industrial levels really is what we need to imagine are stronger hurricanes, typhoons, and the frequent wildfires and floods that we've come to think about as seasons of chaos where people lose their lives. If we go above 2 degrees Celsius, the impacts will be even more severe. That's why it's stunning that the UN Emissions Gap Report shows that if we continue at our current levels, we'll be at 3.2 degrees Celsius by 2100, which is an absolute point of no return. This is an existential threat for human survival and for the people who inhabit the planet. So it feels like a lot of numbers flying around. But ultimately, what we need to know is that this is our last best chance to limit global emissions and really take this on with any hope of allowing for us to enjoy a life that feels anything similar to what the previous generations have been able to experience. And so, yeah, it's difficult to get people to wrap their minds around why we have to stop doing what we're doing. But even in the midst of all the great reporting that's come out, we've only increased our emissions rather than cutting them down. And that's pretty disheartening, given how much advocacy, activism, and real heart has gone into the climate fight.
That was Tamara Tolles-O'Loughlin, Climate Action Group 350.org's North America Director. Find links to recent UN reports on the inadequacy of international efforts to address climate change by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. In recent weeks, corporate news headlines shouting alarm about jittery Democrats' fear that leading progressive candidates in the Democratic field, Massachusetts Senator Elizabeth Warren and Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders, were too radical to win the general election against Donald Trump. One news story highlighted the anxiety of a large donor who offered $1 million to a major Democratic campaign group with one condition: the money would be refunded if Senator Warren won the party's nomination. The concerns expressed by Democratic insiders about the danger of the party moving in a radical direction was likely a large part of the motivation for two moderate candidates, former Massachusetts Governor Deval Patrick and former New York City Mayor and billionaire Michael Bloomberg's late decision to enter the primary race. While former President Barack Obama has said little publicly about the party's 2020 primary campaign, in mid-November he addressed a gathering of the Democrats' largest donors and warned party primary candidates to avoid moving too far left in their policy proposals. Your reporter spoke with Norman Solomon, co-founder and national coordinator of RootsAction.org and a Bernie Sanders delegate from California to the 2016 Democratic National Convention. Here he talks about the recent corporate Democrat and media attacks on Warren and Sanders for their progressive policy positions advocating a wealth tax, Medicare for all, and free college education.
There are so many programs, as you alluded to, that have much public support, not from the mass media, not from most of the sources that we get news and information from, broadcast, cable, print, and even online, but really from the grassroots. If you have polling data, for instance, about a wealth tax, overwhelming support from the U.S. public for a wealth tax along the lines of what Elizabeth Warren has proposed. Not only the Warren campaign, but Bernie Sanders calling for drastic progressive taxation, which makes complete sense in terms of going where the money is rather than going into the pockets of middle-income, lower-income people who are already, to put it mildly, very stretched. Another example is tuition-free public college. When you think about it, K through 12 is free, and people had to fight for that. Now we take it for granted. Why are colleges so expensive compared to a generation or two ago when people didn't have to pay hardly anything in many cases for public college tuition? Now, even state universities are sometimes prohibitively expensive. So the call for tuition-free public college is, again, another example, has tremendous public support, except on Wall Street, except in the upper reaches of corporate media. And I think as we are here now in December of 2019, we're seeing that played out across the board in media coverage and in the political crossfire for the presidential race.
So in your article, corporate media wants anybody but Warren or Sanders. You talk about the bias that is really present in a lot of the analysis we get in our media system, where these progressive policy proposals are discussed in a way that, first of all, they're not popular. Second of all, a candidate who proposes such quote-unquote radical, too far left proposals doesn't have a chance of being elected. Norman, tell us a bit about your assessment of the tone of the media coverage of both Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders and where you think they get it wrong.
I think in terms of context, it's helpful to remember that the New Deal was pushed through and made law in the 1930s against the tremendous opposition of the press lords of the day. The corporate media of the time despised FDR, very opposed to the New Deal, but pressure from the bottom got it done. And so here, as presidential candidates are running for the 2020 Democratic nomination, we also have this sort of dualism. We have this disconnect between what has tremendous support at the grassroots and what we hear from the mass media. And certainly Bernie Sanders has taken the brunt of the flack all this year from a lot of corporate sources. And as Elizabeth Warren has risen in the polls, she too has gotten a more fierce attack from a lot of corporate media sources, as well as some of her so-called center lane opponents for the nomination, you know, Klobuchar, Biden, Buttigieg, Booker, Harris. These are folks who are basically corporate-oriented politicians. They flirt with progressive populism. They don't want to consummate it. They've got their fingers to the wind. And so in a real sense, I believe this is, at this point, a campaign between the progressive forces represented by Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren and basically everybody else who's running for the Democratic nomination. And, of course, the most obscene, not only ally of the oligarchy, but an oligarch himself, is Michael Bloomberg. So you have, like, the mask taken off. I think it was John Jay, the first Chief Justice of the U.S. Supreme Court, who said that those who own the country should run it. And in a sense, that's what Michael Bloomberg is saying. He's already taken out a tremendous amount of paid advertising. He thinks he can buy the election, and we'll see if that's the case.
That was Norman Solomon, co-founder and national coordinator of RootsAction.org. Find more perspectives on the Democratic Party primary campaign and popular support for progressive policy proposals by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. The 50th annual Indigenous Day of Mourning took place in Plymouth, Massachusetts on November 28th, the day others celebrate as Thanksgiving. This event has been organized for the last half century by the United American Indians of New England. It was held on Coles Hill, near a statue of the Wampanoag chief Massasoit, above Plymouth Rock, as whitecaps roiled the ocean and a light rain fell. On this day, only Indigenous people speak, reminding those gathered round about historic injustices as well as current ones. Since the late 1970s, the event has included the reading of a letter sent for the occasion by imprisoned Indigenous leader Leonard Peltier. During the mid-1970s, the Pine Ridge Lakota Reservation in South Dakota had the highest murder rate in the country, as those trying to live a more traditional lifestyle were terrorized by the tribal chairman and his allies, who actually called themselves the Goon Squad. The traditionalists requested security help from the American Indian Movement. Two FBI agents who drove onto the reservation were involved in a firefight and were killed, along with a native man whose death was never investigated. Two AIM members were arrested, but were later acquitted of the murders of the agents based on self-defense. Another AIM member, Leonard Peltier, fled to Canada, where he was extradited back to the U.S. based on perjured testimony. No evidence tied him directly to the crime, and the prosecution withheld exculpatory evidence. Peltier, who's always denied killing the agents, was convicted and sentenced to two consecutive life terms in prison. He's currently held at the federal penitentiary in Cullman, Florida, far from his family, and where he suffers with serious health problems. Peltier sends annual greetings to those gathered for the Thanksgiving Day of Mourning, read here by Bert Waters, a Wampanoag elder.
The day of 2019 is coming to a close, and with it comes the day most Americans set aside as a day of Thanksgiving. As I let my mind wander beyond the steel bars and concrete walls, I try to imagine what the people who live outside the prison gates are doing and what they are thinking. Do they ever think of the Indigenous people who were forced from their homelands? Do they understand that with every step they take, no matter the direction, that they are walking on stolen land. Can they imagine, even for 1 minute, what it is like to watch the suffering of the women, the children, and the babies? Yes, the sick and elderly, as they were made to keep pushing west in freezing temperatures with little or no food. These were my people, and this was our land. There was a time when we enjoyed freedom and were able to hunt buffalo and gather the foods and sacred medicines. We were able to fish. We were able to enjoy clean water. My people were generous. We shared everything we had, including the knowledge of how to survive the long, harsh winters or the hot, humid summers. Look at the brilliant young people who put themselves at risk, fighting to keep our water and environment clean and safe from the generations yet to come. They are willing to confront the giant multinational corporations by educating the general public of the devastation being caused. I smile with hope when I think of them. They are fearless and ready to speak the truth to all who are willing to listen. We also remember our brothers and sisters in Bolivia who are rioting in support of the first indigenous president, Evo Morales. His commitment to the people, the land, their resources, and protection against corruption is commendable. We recognize and identify with that struggle so well. So today, I thank all the people who are willing to have an open mind, those who are willing to accept the responsibility of planning for 7 generations ahead, those who remember the sacrifices made by our ancestors so we can continue to speak our own language, practice our own way of thankfulness in our own skin, and that we always acknowledge and respect the indigenous lineage that we carry. For those of you who are thankful that you have enough food to feed your families, please give to those who aren't as fortunate. If you are warm and have a comfortable shelter to live in, please give to those who are cold and homeless. If you are someone hurting and in need of kind words or two, be that person who steps forward and lends a hand. And especially when you see injustice anywhere, please be brave enough to speak up to confront it. I want to thank all who are kind enough to remember me and my family in your thoughts and prayers. Thank you for continuing to support and believe in me. There isn't a minute in any day that passes without me hoping that this will be the day I will be granted freedom. I long for the day when I can smell clean, fresh air, when I can feel a gentle breeze in my hair, witness the clouds as their movement hides the sun, and when the moon shines, the light on the path of the sacred Inipi. That would truly be a day I could call a day of thanksgiving. My spirit is there with you, Daksha, in the spirit of Crazy Horse, Leonard Peer.
That was Bert Waters, a Wampanoag elder, reading Leonard Peltier's annual greeting at the Thanksgiving Day of Mourning event at Plymouth, Massachusetts. This segment was recorded and produced by Between the Lines Melinda Tuhus. Learn more about the annual Day of Mourning and U.S. political prisoner Leonard Peltier by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our mobile-friendly website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio and support our show. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Thanks for listening on WZBC in Newton, Massachusetts, WRIR in Richmond, Virginia, KPOV in Bend, Oregon, and dozens of other community radio stations across the U.S. and abroad. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Mary Hunt, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris. And now we hear an encore presentation of Between the Lines, featuring timely, in-depth progressive analysis. Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Yousef Munir, Executive Director of the U.S. Campaign for Palestinian Rights, who examines President Trump's declaration that Israeli settlements built on Palestinian land do not violate international law. Diallo Brooks of People for the American Way, who discusses his group's call for President Trump to fire his white nationalist senior advisor, Stephen Miller, whose incriminating emails have recently been published by the Southern Poverty Law Center, and a report on climate activists who organized direct action protests at the new Cricket Valley frack gas power plant in New York State, demanding that it never be opened. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
Former Sri Lanka Defense Minister Gotabaya Rajapaksa, known to his siblings as the Terminator, was elected the new president of the South Asian nation, still recovering from a decades-long civil war. Rajapaksa, the brother of Sri Lanka's former president, has raised concern among Muslims and ethnic minorities of a possible wave of political and ethnic repression in the aftermath of the deadly attack by the Islamic State terrorist group last April that killed 250 people. The new president won the November 16th election by appealing to the Sinhala Buddhist majority, many of whom are consumed with worry about economic insecurity. Sri Lankan observers fear that with the return of the Rajapaksas to power, the nation will face a return to the repressive era of Buddhist nationalism. Sri Lanka has never come to terms with the gross human rights abuses committed during the 30-year civil war with the Tamil Tigers guerrilla group that ended in 2009. More than 40,000 civilians were killed in the final offensive against the separatist rebels. In 2015, the UN Human Rights Council urged Sri Lanka to set up a special judicial process to try war criminals. But thus far, Sri Lanka has not acted, prompting UN Human Rights Commissioner Michelle Bachelet to warn, continuing impunity risks fueling communal or inter-ethnic violence. During the presidency of Gotabaya's brother, Mahinda Rajapaksa, journalists and government critics were routinely abducted, tortured, and killed at the height of the civil war. Since President George W. Bush's 2003 invasion of Iraq to depose Saddam Hussein, Iran has played a pivotal behind-the-scenes role in Iraq, giving its stamp of approval to several prime ministers. Tehran actively recruited former CIA operatives as the U.S. withdrew thousands of troops in 2011. The extent of Iran's influence inside Iraqi politics was revealed in the recent release of 700 pages of Iranian intelligence cables obtained by the Intercept news site. According to the leaked documents, Iraq's Prime Minister Adil Abdul Mahdi, who lived in exile in Iran while Saddam Hussein was in power, has a special relationship with the Islamic Republic. When he rose to power last year, Mahdi was seen as a compromise candidate acceptable to both Iran and the United States. When the U.S. invasion toppled Saddam Hussein, Iran placed its top intelligence officers and Revolutionary Guards operatives inside Iraq. Now, with violent protests in Baghdad and southern Iraq, pro-Iranian political parties are on the defensive. Parties with close relationships with Tehran have seen their headquarters burned down and top party officials assassinated. Protesters across the country are demanding an end to corruption and the ouster of Prime Minister Mahdi, and denounced Iran's outsized influence in Iraqi politics. Thanks to a $50 million public-private partnership launched by a group of private donors and matched by the city of Atlanta, the city is pursuing an initiative to end homelessness and to prevent the poor from slipping through cracks in the social safety net. In-Town Collaborative Ministries, one of the nonprofit agencies receiving funding for the program, is now moving more homeless people into what's called permanent supportive housing. The goal is not just to provide people a home, but also to ensure they receive the wraparound services necessary to help rebuild wounded lives. Clients enrolled in the program receive assistance to help navigate the bureaucracy as they move into permanent homes. They also receive services such as counseling, health care, and transportation. Research has shown that permanent supportive housing can reduce the public cost of the most common and expensive alternatives, temporarily sheltering, hospitalizing, or imprisoning homeless people. Through this initiative, homelessness in Atlanta has declined each year for over a decade, and the city's program is now seen as a national model for some of the nation's largest municipalities, including Los Angeles and San Francisco, where the numbers of homeless have dramatically increased in recent years. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Ruth Ann Baumgartner.
President Trump, in another action that smashed the norms and conventions of U.S. foreign policy, has broken with the long-standing worldwide consensus that Israeli settlements built on occupied Palestinian land constitutes a violation of international law. Trump's Secretary of State, Mike Pompeo, announced on November 18th that the U.S. will no longer abide by a 1978 State Department legal opinion that the settlements were inconsistent with international law. This latest move continues a pattern of the Trump regime, overturning decades of U.S. Middle East policies. In 2017, Trump recognized Jerusalem as the capital of Israel, and in March, Trump recognized Israel's 1981 annexation of the occupied Golan Heights. A succession of United Nations Security Council resolutions, the most recent in 2016, determined that Israeli settlements are illegal as they violate the Fourth Geneva Convention, which prohibits an occupying power from transferring its population to the territory it occupies. Hanan Ashrawi, a veteran Palestinian negotiator and member of the Palestine Liberation Organization's Executive Committee, said that Trump's action was another blow to international law, justice, and peace. In response to Trump's policy change, Day of Rage protests erupted on November 26th in the Palestinian West Bank. Your reporter spoke with Yousef Munir, executive director of the U.S. Campaign for Palestinian Rights, who assesses the likely repercussions from Mr. Trump's reversal of U.S. policy on Israeli settlements.
So I think there's a couple different ways to think about this announcement, both of which are important. First of all, this announcement is in line with a number of different steps that the Trump administration has taken that have really been ideologically driven and focused specifically on dismantling everything that has been known as the peace process, and specifically, you know, any achievements and any hopes that Palestinians had. So you look, for example, at recognizing Jerusalem as the capital of Israel, or on recognition of the Golan Heights as Israeli territory, or on the position towards the United Nations Relief Works Agency, UNRWA, and Palestinian refugees, or on the closing of the Palestinian delegation here in the United States and cutting off all aid, including U.S. aid support to Palestinians. This is part of a systemic effort to entirely and overtly align U.S. policy with the most extreme right-wing fantasies in Israel. At the same time, I think it's important to keep in mind that while, yes, Pompeo's announcement is part of this broader ideological project that the Trump administration has been engaged in, I think it is a mistake to say that it really realigns U.S. policy when it comes to settlements in particular. I think the unfortunate reality is that while there is broad international consensus about settlements being illegal under international law, previous American administrations, including the Obama administration, the Bush administration, Clinton, and so on before them, across party lines, have hesitated and in fact objected to the issue of settlements being adjudicated in the framework of international law and within international institutions. You know, the Obama administration, for example, vetoed the United Nations Security Council resolution in 2011, which called the illegal Israeli settlements illegal, precisely because they did not want that kind of language and framing to define how the issue should be resolved.
Yosef, I wanted to ask you about Benjamin Netanyahu, who is still prime minister despite his indictment and turmoil in Israeli politics, who in the past has called for the annexation of the West Bank and East Jerusalem, but in the past has not taken action to trigger that change. But now with the Trump administration policy announcement here on not viewing Israeli settlements as illegal under international law, might that not change at this point?
I think it's very possible that the announcement by Pompeo will lead to further steps by the Israelis when it comes to, you know, annexation formally or whatever else. I would disagree with the idea that the Israelis have not taken steps towards annexation. I think in many ways they have already annexed the territory in every possible way, but with a formal announcement. And so, you know, there's a lot that has been done, especially over the last 10 years under the leadership of Netanyahu, where the Israelis have entrenched their control in further parts of the West Bank than ever before, and began to lay the legal foundation, the legalistic foundation, to really enact annexation at some point in time. You know, there used to be a TV game show called Supermarket Sweeps. If you remember this show, the idea was the contestants would have, you know, 2 minutes to run through the supermarket aisles, collect all of the goods, and they'd be at the end. The Israelis have approached the Trump administration in the very same way. They understand they have a limited period of time in which they can extract some of the greatest fantasies that they ever had, that they could not have imagined a American administration agreeing to. And they know that that time may very well be running out. And so they have tried to get as much as they could from the Trump administration: recognition of Jerusalem, again, cutting off the Palestinians and the refugees, recognition of the Golan Heights, and now, of course, this announcement on the settlements. It may very well be the case that with time ticking down on the Trump administration's first term and potentially last term, they will try to take further irreversible steps like announcing annexation after this announcement. It certainly would be consistent with the pattern of Israeli policy during the Trump administration.
That was Yosef Munir, Executive Director of the U.S. Campaign for Palestinian Rights. Find more perspectives on the Trump regime's policies on Israel-Palestine by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. The Southern Poverty Law Center, a group dedicated to fighting hate and bigotry, has received, reviewed, and released a series of leaked email correspondence between Stephen Miller who serves as President Trump's senior advisor for policy, and a former editor at the extreme right publication Breitbart News, Katie McHugh, who leaked the emails to the SPLC. The email exchange, which took place before the 2016 election, reveals Miller's alignment with white nationalist thought and far-right extremism. Miller, the architect of Trump's vicious and inhumane immigration policies, forwarded McHugh articles from websites steeped in racism, xenophobia, and debunked conspiracy theories. Miller, who was then an aide to Alabama Senator Jeff Sessions, also sent McHugh information about immigrant crime and offered her talking points on defending Confederate iconography in the wake of the white nationalist Dylann Roof's massacre of black churchgoers in Charleston, South Carolina. Since the release of these emails, civil rights activist groups and more than 100 Democratic members of Congress have demanded that President Trump fire Miller. However, the White House rejects any criticism and remains supportive of Miller, while Republicans have largely remained silent on the emails that link Miller to extremist and hateful ideology. Your reporter spoke with Diallo Brooks, People for the American Way's Senior Director of Outreach and Partner Engagement. Here he discusses the significance of Miller's emails and the growing calls for his firing.
We've known from some of Stephen Miller's early writings or writings in college when he attended Duke University of having some connections, which he's denied, interactions with some white supremacists and particularly a white nationalist named Richard Spencer. And he has done writings and made a lot of comments about various immigration policies that we feel are very problematic. You know, he's driving the policy around the separation of migrant children. He is working on denying green cards for applicants who seek welfare assistance from the government, banning immigrants from Muslim-majority countries from entering the U.S., repealing protections for immigrants who were brought to the United States through no fault of their own as children. As folks have uncovered, his ties to white nationalism and white supremacy are driving this debate. And as he's made this connection to this white nationalist figure, it's become clear for folks to really realize that. And it's time for the White House to remove him from office.
Diallo, can we connect Stephen Miller directly with what many would label as state violence when thousands of children are separated from their parents at the border with this crackdown on immigration that's come through the Trump administration? There have been cases where children have died in custody. Certainly hundreds of other detainees have also died and suffered a great deal. To many, this would appear to be state violence, which has claimed lives. Can we trace that back to Stephen Miller and his influence on Donald Trump?
Oh, definitely. I mean, if we look at Stephen Miller's, like I said, his influence within the White House, these are policies that he is driving. And he's come out on various talk shows and talked about the importance of these policies. And he has the president's ear, and the president is basically getting the playbook from Stephen Miller. And it's very scary, very problematic, and has real-life impact on real people, having somebody that is connected to white nationalism, and I would say a racist that's sitting in the White House driving the president's decision on immigration and so many other policies that affect communities of color and affect Americans as a whole.
Diallo, review for our listeners the kinds of organizations as well as Democratic legislators who are calling for Stephen Miller to be fired, actually.
Yeah, I mean, we're part of a large coalition of organizations. It's People for the American Way, organizations like Move On. There's organizations like Public Citizen and others that are calling on Stephen Miller to be fired. And we've all seen the documentation. We've always known that he's been problematic, problematic addition to the White House. And as new information continues to come out, as this leaked information continues to come out, we see his direct ties, and he's driving Trump to rely on these far-right conspiracy theories. These are very fringy, extremist ideas that are getting mainstream play within the White House. And as People for the American Way and our partner organizations, we have to hold this White House accountable. We have to make sure that even as bad as the White House has been on many different policies, that this is absolutely unacceptable to have a white nationalist driving our immigration policy and driving a white nationalist agenda from within the White House.
Should Congress begin investigations into Stephen Miller, his association with racist organizations, because he is a prominent member of this White House? We do have a First Amendment. People can say awful things and be protected. And I don't think many of us would want to trade that away. On the other hand, what should Congress's response be here?
Well, I think Congress should have a role. They should do their job just like they're doing with the impeachment process, is really investigate anything that they feel like is a wrongdoing within this administration. That is their responsibility. So them stepping to the plate, making sure that things are functioning the way they should function within the law, they're supposed to be the checks and balance. People are paying attention. People are organizing. And Congress has to watch that as well and make sure that they're doing the right thing and doing everything within their power to hold this administration accountable.
That was Diallo Brooks, People for the American Way Senior Director of Outreach and Partner Engagement. Find links to the Southern Poverty Law Center's archive of Stephen Miller's emails by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. On November 16th, scores of residents from New York and Connecticut converged on the site of the Cricket Valley Energy Center, the largest frack gas power plant in the Northeast, to demand that New York Governor Andrew Cuomo shut it down before its scheduled opening due to climate and environmental impacts. The plant is located in Dutchess County, New York, a few miles from the Connecticut border. Residents in both states are concerned about the methane, other global warming gases, and contaminants that will be released into the atmosphere. Before dawn, 10 protesters locked themselves to a tractor in the power plant's parking lot, while four others scaled the 275-foot smokestack and perched on the walkway at the top for almost 12 hours. The climate activists succeeded in shutting down the plant for the day. 29 protesters were arrested on charges of trespass, and the four on the smokestack were charged with criminal trespass. The 1,100-megawatt plant is scheduled to open in early 2020. The company building it says it could power a million homes and partially replace the power that will be lost when the nearby Indian Point nuclear plant closes in a few years. But opponents maintain that replacing nuclear power with fossil fuels is the wrong direction to go. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus was at the protest action, which was enlivened by Reverend Billy's Church of Stop Shopping Choir. In the following report, she speaks with some of the protest participants, including a first-year student at nearby Vassar College named Martin.
We have a Sunrise XR Extinction Rebellion Hub at Vassar. It started like this semester. We're super small, but it encourages students to go to events like this. This just kind of came up in terms of like our agenda, and we happily reached out. So there are a bunch of Vassar students, one's right next to me, that's Max, that are just super excited to be participating in this. I think for a lot of us this is like our first real event of trespassing, and I think this has been a great experience so far. Yeah, we've been out here since like 5 in the morning. Yeah, so we got to set up this barrier very early. We even had to let some of the workers who are already here go, which I thought was a pretty good move on us. It was nice.
What do you mean you had to let some of the workers go? What happened?
So we arrived at about 5:30, and there were already workers here. And so like our goal with this kind of soft blockade right now is to prevent anyone else from coming in. and we didn't realize that there were people already there from like maybe a night shift. So that kind of came up in like the second hour of the protest. I think the day's work here is canceled, which is a huge victory for us. So they were instructed to leave. We handed out some flyers. I was talking to one of the outreach people and they said like 5% of them were super behind us. Like we got some thumbs up. One person even said, "I'm with you." We were really respecting the workers. They weren't the villains in the story.
My name is Johanna Fallert. I'm with Mothers Out Front, Dutchess County. We've been opposed to the Cricket Valley Energy Center. And we've held many actions. We went to town boards to talk to the people about what this plant represented. When you burn natural gas, you're putting pollutants into the air that harm people and harm the environment. They accelerate global warming. In 2011, an environmental study was conducted. And based on that environmental study that this plant would not harm the environment, a permit was granted in 2012 to build this plant. Now we're here in 2019. It took 5 years to find the foreign investors and national investors so that they could make profit over people. We've gone to town boards, to school boards to warn about the dangers. In April, we presented a petition to the Department of Environmental Conservation, the governor, and other New York State legislators, asking them to conduct a supplemental environmental impact study of Cricket Valley. Because since 2011, we have a host of research from climate scientists and medical experts that say we cannot continue to put natural gas emissions into the air. We can't continue to burn natural gas. This plant has to be stopped, and it has to be stopped sooner rather than later. Just three quarters of a mile away from here, there's a middle school, high school complex of 800 school children. Children are more vulnerable to pollutants than other groups of people, as are the elderly, as are people who have immune systems that are compromised because of their lung conditions or cardiac conditions. This is a danger to humanity. And what we do here affects the world. The air doesn't belong to Dover. It belongs to all of us.
I wanted to ask you a question. One of the articles I read about this said that this is being proposed to fulfill half of the energy that's now being provided by Indian Point Nuclear Plant when it closes down. So does your group have a position on nuclear power? And do you think that what should have been done instead of building the frack gas plant?
Well, this may have been a good idea back in 2009 and 10 when they were conceiving of this plant. It's not a good idea now because we know that there are alternatives. If they had taken the $1.5 billion that they had put into this plant, into the research that's required for renewable energies, we'd be far ahead of where we are now. We have geothermal, we have solar, we have all forms of renewable energy, wind, and those are the forms that don't hurt people, and those are what we have to pursue.
Our report on the November 16th direct action protest at Dutchess County, New York's Cricket Valley Frack Gas Power Plant was recorded and produced by Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus. Learn more about opposition to the gas plant by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our mobile-friendly website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio and support our show. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Thanks for listening on Progressive Voices Network, Spotify, Google Podcasts, Stitcher, iHeartRadio, Apple Podcasts, Castro, CastBox, TuneIn Alexa, and dozens of community radio stations across the U.S. and abroad. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Ruth Ann Baumgartner, Susan Bramhall, Mary Hunt, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.